Welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie.
Greetings and welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie, a retro podcast dedicated to the pop culture of the 80s, 90s and zeros. My name is Jason.
And I'm Rich.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Steve.
And with the recent 30th anniversary of the UK release of Jurassic Park, we grabbed this opportunity to discuss one of the best films ever made. So please join us as we have spared no expense and find out that life does indeed find a way as we jump into Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park.
We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
The most phenomenal discovery of our time.
How'd you do this?
Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
Can I touch it?
Sure.
Universal Pictures presents.
You feel that?
Hold on to your butts.
A Steven Spielberg film.
Senses are failing all over the park.
Yeah, that's nice. Gotta go.
An adventure.
Look out! Go!
I can't get Jurassic Park back online.
65 million years in the making. Jurassic Park.
Look, I'm not gonna even bother to go through the plot. I mean, we all know the plot, right? I mean, everyone knows the plot. Do I really need to go through the plot? I don't think I need to.
This is the plot of, what was it? Sorry, Jurassic Park, did you say?
That's the one, yes, Steve.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that one. Yeah.
That's right then. I think we're good, aren't we?
Yep, opened a theme park of dinosaurs and everything was fine.
Yeah.
Made lots of money and...
yeah. Yep. All right. Okay, yeah. Everyone knows the plot, so I'm not going to waste my breath. But... coming up on this episode, we do try to figure out where the series needs to go next and consider if it does need a reboot. What's our favourite scene from the film Jurassic Park? And we give our verdict and score on the film. Will this be our first full 40 score? You can see why I got my tongue twisted on that. And we had some... listeners send in their thoughts and feelings on the film, which we will share too. I say listeners, it was just a listener. Still a great...
pluralise it, Jason, make it seem...
I'm trying. I'm all tongue-twisted all of a sudden, you know.
We could give their thoughts twice and then it's listeners.
There you go, I like it.
And that listener is Sam Neill.
Yeah, what are the odds?
Wouldn't that be something? But anyway, to start us off, we share our memories of seeing Jurassic Park for the first time and what impact it had on us afterwards. And Chris, let's kick off with you, mate.
Well, it was 93. Was it summer of 93 we got it? So I was probably not even, I was about 9.5. And when you see a dinosaur movie where the dinosaurs escape, eat people, and hijinks ensue, and the whole thing just goes... mad, that stays with you so much so that it's still one of my all-time favorite films, and I'd probably watch it maybe once or twice every year or two. I remember being obsessed with it because we got the trailers, and it was in listeners might be able to back me up here, but it was in like catalogs. The toy run-up was in catalogs as before the trailer, I believe, was even out. I remember vividly sitting on the floor in my childhood home going, that's Jurassic Park stuff. It's dinosaurs. I actually still have the original red T-Rex from Kenner somewhere. Then the trailers hit, and then I don't think I've seen it since where a film had merchandise out so early to grab onto the merchandising train before the film came out. Now, I had friends that lived around me who... their dad took them to see it, and I was quite late seeing it, I believe, because I didn't have that access to it. So when my mum finally took us to see it, it was just like, what is this? This has just completely changed my life and fundamental understanding of how movies look and are made. And it was the first film that got me into reading making of books, because I was that obsessed. And I've been obsessed with how films are made since. And I've got the making of book behind me by, is it Don Shea and Jodie Duncan? The book actually has a cameo in the film, which I always blew me away on the shelf as it goes past. And I would sit and look at all the pictures of the props, locations, the sets, how they were rigged, everything. And I read that book cover to cover for years. So I think that film came at the perfect time in my life for me to appreciate movies as an art form, and just changed the way I viewed movies and the way what they could do to you, like on a almost subliminal level, because you're watching this massive popcorn flick, but you're perfectly structured is Steven Spielberg's quintessential 90s masterpiece, I'd want to say. And it was like the perfect storm of movies. I was speechless the three times I saw it in the theatre after that. I couldn't get enough of it. And again, I went through two VHS copies because I think I just wore the magnetic tape out in the VHS machine. Yeah, and I still got a lot of the stuff today that I couldn't part with when I was growing up. I just boxed it up when I moved out and went to college, and I still have it somewhere. I think some of it's on the shelf behind me, but yeah, it's just that perfect storm of a movie at the perfect time of my life, and I think our lives, I think, really is going to be the case here. So yeah, that was my intro into this film, and anything with dinosaurs that weren't stop motion, and that was just mind-blowing. That was absolutely, still to this day, I want to see a film and have that same feeling, and I've yet to find that moment since 1993.
Yeah, for me, I think up to that point, I was already like really quite obsessed with dinosaurs. So I was watching a lot of the films that would have played late night on Channel 4. Usually would tape them, watch them the next morning. So like your The Land That Time Forgot, Dinosaurus.
Oh, I'm glad you brought up Dinosaurus. I love it. It doesn't make any sense, but I love it.
Yeah, there's like the one with Raquel Welch. I always forget if it's 10 million years BC or 60 million years BC, but that's obviously loads of stop motion dinosaurs and that. So that was kind of my gateway drug, and I loved it. Obviously, I'm young, little kid. I don't care about the effects. I see dinosaurs on the screen, and I'm just like, I'm lapping it up. Love it. And obviously, this film came out, and it's just a spectacle, and probably this is the first film that I actually went to see in a cinema other than Ghostbusters 2. So this would have been the first time I went with my parents to a film since then. And by then I was what, coming up on 10 years old. So I was already kind of getting a bit more mature to appreciate the experience. I bought into the hype. It wasn't just some day out to watch a fun film based on something I watched as a kid on TV, you know, in the case of Ghostbusters. I'd seen a lot of the hype leading into it, and obviously again this was like a pre-internet age, so really the hype consisted of watching movies, games and videos on a Saturday on ITV with Steve Priestley, you know, showing you some clips, and I was like, oh, what's this, and then seeing the ads on TV. And like what Chris said, the merchandise came out ahead of time to kind of pull you in, and I got the Diamond Damage T-Rex. I got obviously the Raptor. You pull the legs back so it screeches. I was completely on board for this film. Completely on board.
I've got one of those.
Yep. Still, fantastic. And yeah, I still remember the day. I have recollections of when I went to cinema with my mum and dad to watch it. And the thing that still sticks out to me was just how loud it was. Mm. And as a kid, I was just like, I was just on the precipice of being too scared to want to watch the rest of it, but I was so enthralled and just blown away and fascinated. I just wanted to go on this ride. I wasn't like, Mum, Dad, oh yeah, I want to go home, take me out. I was on board, and I was so in love with this film. like from the opening with the raptor in the cage to the climax, just every second I was just hooked. And what I loved about it, and I think I appreciated this even at a young age, what I loved about it was that even the actual merchandising was baked into the film. It wasn't this thing that was separate. It was almost kind of meta in a way that Jurassic Park was an IP within the film, and you saw the lunchboxes in the gift shop. You saw even the fact that you've got the logo on the doors of the visitor jeeps. You've got uniforms. It's on the bloody gates, for God's sake. It's just...
Don't forget the dinosaur plushies, which I never...
And the dinosaur plushies.
I never got one. I was so pissed when I was a kid.
Yeah, where's my Dilophosaur plushie?
God, I wanted a Velociraptor plushie, and I never got one.
But yeah, it just did so much to me, that film. Like, again, it's obviously scratched my dinosaur itch, and it was the first time I'd seen... I think it was the first time we'd all seen the CGI and the use of visual effects. It just felt so real, and it still really holds up. 30 years later, I still rate it higher than some Marvel films that come out, where it's just oversaturation of CGI now. This, every shot, whether it was a mixture of physical or practical CGI, it matters. And you actually realize, actually, in a way, how few visual effects shots are on the film. It's like,
I think it's like eight minutes in it, something. Or
it's insane. Yeah. It's insane. But because it matters, it feels like it's 50% of the film, because your mind is filling in the blanks so much, and you're so like rooted into that location. You feel like you're there. That even when you're not seeing dinosaurs on screen, you feel like they are around you. It's a masterclass in filmmaking. And whether it's from a young age, seeing it when I was an impressionable 10-year-old, to now, like on the precipice of 40, it just holds up. It just makes me so happy to watch this film. And it's not one of those things where it's like, you know, a lot of stuff nowadays where you look at it with this kind of like social media nostalgia, where you just talk about it and put a little cute post out to talk about, oh, you know, if you'd like this, your childhood was awesome and was shit. It's like, this film matters so much to me. And yeah, I just adore it. And yeah, I can't say any more than that, really. This is like my childhood, this film.
Mm-hmm.
And even films I followed that kind of had that same vibe, whether it's Independence Day or, hell, even at the time, Godzilla 98, I was on board for that. I was like, hell yeah, this is going to be amazing. Nothing comes close to Jurassic Park. There was just the perfect time, the perfect film. It lined up with my interests, what I was intrigued by at the time. And it was an experience I got with my mum and dad, where they loved the film as well. And it was just spectacular. So
it's funny with what you're saying, well, about the parents, and like the scary parts of the film, because this was a PG, wasn't it?
This is the first time I saw it. It had that kind of like little, what's the word, almost like a disclaimer on a poster, like not suitable for those under 8 or of a nervous disposition. It was like, right, okay. Ooh, this is like fucking hot. At the time I was like, hell yeah, I want to watch this. This is going to be some cool stuff in it. Like, I still remember that. And this, obviously, you know, it wasn't this film. It was actually Mrs. Doubtfire that kicked off the 12 or 12A thing. And it's surprising that this film got by with a PG, and it actually still carries a PG.
Yeah.
Some films have actually had their ratings changed like retroactively. Even I think like Ghostbusters is like 12 now, I think. Probably because of the blowjob, but I don't know.
So I think I've talked about this before on this podcast. The first film that I saw in the cinema was either Home Alone or Disney's Peter Pan. But in my heart, spiritually, this is the first film that I actually saw in the cinema. Because I think those other two, I was just kind of dragged along and I didn't really know what was going on. I was like, cool, I'll sit in this big dark room and watch whatever's going on. But with this film, I had friends at school who had already seen it and I'd heard about it and I'd seen it on TV, like on, you know, TV spots or on the news or whatever. And I remember vividly seeing the Gallimimus scene where they hide behind the log while all the dinosaurs run over the log. And I was like, what the fuck? Those are dinosaurs. How are they doing a dinosaur film with dinosaurs in it? No understanding of how the fuck they did that, but just suddenly having a deep, deep need to see this fucking film. And so I went into it knowing what film I was seeing, and I'd never done that before in a cinema. And I went with my parents and my grandma, and it was the first time that I felt overwhelmed in a cinema. Like Rich was saying, incredibly loud, to the point where I'm a terrified child, but I fucking love how terrifying and just overwhelming and awe-inspiring it was. And like, I turned up thinking I'm going to see some dinosaurs, but like the opening scene is kind of moody, and you know, they're bringing the velociraptor in that cage, and you don't really see the velociraptor, and then it gets a bit loose and it grabs one of the guys, and Muldoon's like, shooter, and all that. And I was like, this isn't what I expected, but like, I sort of, through Jurassic Park, I kind of learned what films could be, and I learned a little bit about the structure of films and how you tell a story. And like Chris, this got me interested in films and how films were made. It's fantastic. And I remember very, very clearly the lawyer getting bitten off the toilet because my grandma absolutely lost her shit. And it, like, in a terrified way. And I lost my shit in a like, oh my God, that just happened. Like, you can't do that. You can't eat a lawyer off a toilet? What the fuck?
She ragdolled him as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, even now, it, like, that's suspicious.
It doesn't just grab him and then, like, yeah, it, like, swings him about. And it was like Steven Spielberg, it turns out, like, that motherfucker can make a film. And when you get to that point, like, you've waited so long for it, like, he really makes you work for it. And then that's the first time in that film, really, that something, like, pretty explicitly violent happens. And it's shocking in all the best ways. And, yeah, it's just great. And then I came out of this film, like, I need more CGI. I want more visual effects. And if a film came out that had CGI in it, I was like, I want to see it because I need more of that. Not unlike Chris, no other film really, you know, measured up to it. But yeah, so I liked it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I don't think I had the same kind of experiences in the cinema that you guys did with Jurassic Park because of the age difference that we've got between us. Like, I think I must have been 14, maybe touching 15. I can't even remember seeing it in the cinema. I know I did, but the memory is not vivid enough for me to like go back to. I find that particularly quite weird. I'm pretty certain I saw this in the cinema. I had to have, you know. Like I said, I was at that age range where I was very much interested in films. I'd love going to the cinema, so I must have seen it. But I don't know, I think I walked out and I just didn't have the same kind of connection, I guess, that you guys did with the film at that point in my life. I think, you know, I probably walked out and went, you know what, that was a really cool film. Shit me up a little bit, lovely jubbly, let's move on to whatever else I'm going to be doing with my time. Yeah, and I feel a little bit sad about that, I guess, but I don't know if that's just my age.
Respect you a lot less now, to be honest.
what film was your Jurassic Park like? If it's prior or even a year later, what was that formative like cinema experience early on?
I don't know, really. Like,
normal people would say Jurassic Park.
I know, right? I'm not normal. I mean, I always still go back to the first film I ever saw at the cinema, and that was Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Jesus, you know, Christ.
That's a good answer. Okay, the respect's back.
Oh, good. Phew.
You're going to say, like, Zulu.
Zulu. That's a blanket.
How old do you think I am, man?
Thank you for those bloody spears at me.
Look at them. Thousands of them.
Okay, so I guess, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is, you know, a very... it's a spectacle as well. And if you've seen that in the cinema, I can see how Jurassic Park maybe wouldn't hit the same...
I like Jurassic Park. The opening of Roger Rabbit is like insanely awesome.
Yes.
Like it leaves an impression. Like,
And I think I must have been around the age that you were when you saw Jurassic Park. So I think that probably was my defining cinema moment because it's still etched in my brain, that moment of going to the cinema to see Who Framed Roger Rabbit with my brother.
So lucky.
And just. Absolutely just loving the whole experience. But, you know, we're not here to talk about Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Hopefully one day we will be. But seeing Jurassic Park in the cinema, it was great experience. And I kind of went out and I just kind of moved on to the next film and whatever else. So, yeah. But, you know, over the years, I've rewatched it and I've formed a more, you know, connection to the film and more appreciation for what the film did at the time that it came out and where the film industry was and how much of a defining film this is, not only for, let's say, the story, you know, and bringing back dinosaurs and all that kind of stuff, but obviously the CGI that was still quite new for Hollywood. And, you know, we kind of started to see films starting to bring in CGI that did it well, you know, Terminator 2, for example, you know, but a lot of films were still struggling with it. And this was the first one that just kind of, it kind of fit. It didn't look out of place, you know, and it kind of worked with the practical effects that they used in the film too. And, you know, I've come to grow to love Jurassic Park just as much as everyone else over the years of rewatching it and reading about it and all that, as I've grown up to come to the point of just loving Jurassic Park probably just as much as you guys do. But I just didn't. I just didn't at the time it came out. So abuse me, whatever you want to do, you know, but that's just the facts.
Is this the first, what film came before this that did CGI in this way? Because like Terminator 2 is the other one that people look at as being, you know, that was the start of the burgeoning visual effects industry, but that's like liquid metal, and I feel like that's kind of like cheating, right? Jurassic yeah. Park, it's they're trying to make a thing that looks real and put it in a real shot.
I feel like JP was definitely the first.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
I want to say Jim Cameron's The Abyss, but that's still experimentally kind of Terminator 2-ish territory.
The Abyss looks great, but again, it's kind of abstract, isn't it? Like, I can't think of any other film that's earlier than this that has convincing real-world CGI stuff.
What amazes me is all these YouTubers that are like, you know, they do a top 10 visual effects, don't they? And they're like, oh, Jurassic Park CG takes place at night for a reason. Yes, but what about the Gallimimus hunt that takes place bang smack in the middle of the movie in broad fucking daylight and holds up textually, animation, compositing, everything in broad daylight? And again, broad daylight in the end, it's there and it's. They have the balls to put it full frame right in front of your face and it still looks blinding.
So what's so jarring about that scene in the best way as well is that it's like your first time with the Rex outside of the scene with the visitor Jeep. So you're kind of like, you saw him in the rain at night and then suddenly it's just like, pow, comes out of the trees and it's just, boom.
Sun Look at kissed. All the blood.
Yeah, I just love the way they just throw it at you because all you've seen up to the point is him in the rain or her in the rain at night. Still looking fantastic, but yeah, they just slap you in the face with him. Like, they've just got confidence, like, with the visual effects to do that.
That's what I love about Spielberg as a filmmaker. It's just a constant cock tease the entire film for half of the runtime, and all you can hear are, and I've said before, yeah, cock tease, got ya.
Stop saying that, it's a family podcast.
And then the fight in the museum bit around the skeleton at the end, that's when you come. Yeah,
precisely. And then you chill out and sleep on a helicopter afterwards. like you see the Brachiosaur and you just like, oh yeah, it's great. It's one of the best shots in cinema history where you see it from their angle and it's framed a shot at ankle length, so you're seeing it from their point of view, looking up, and it's misframed because it's so big that it doesn't fit in the frame, and that's deliberate. And so many films these days are like, oh yeah, cameraman's conveniently placed 2 miles away, fine. But by realistically misframing it and then having the camera come up, it works. And then all of a sudden, you got boom, you hear animal noises throughout the entire film. It sets the mood right in the offbeat with that Universal logo that comes around, and you get those jungle sounds.
Still hear like the almost like the crickets, grasshopper
sound. And then you hear sounds that you're not quite sure what they are. You can't identify it within the first 5 seconds. Just with jungle noises, Spielberg's put you at, like, unease. And then,
boom.
This is like, oh, and then throughout the entire film, you're just hearing these things and distant noises. And then it's just like, it's just a full-on sensual onslaught after that. And it's just brilliant.
Sensory or sensual, did you say?
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's been a day.
Jesus.
But we, I mean, Jurassic Park, I mean, we obviously know it was an adaptation from Michael Crichton book, obviously of the same name. And obviously, when when books get adapted into a film, there's always differences, there's always changes to the plot. But I mean, I think this one was probably one of quite a big chop, wasn't it? Or a big moving about of parts of the book and the storyline, wasn't there?
Yeah, super different. I mean, most of the characters are completely different.
Hammond's a bit of a dickhead, isn't he?
Yeah.
Hammond in the book is straight up a rubbing his hands together capitalist evil man. All of the changes that got made for the film were incredibly smart. But, you know, I mean, I read the book a long time ago. I remember liking it. And obviously, you got to credit the book and credit Michael Crichton. But all of the changes that they made for the film. Oh, perfect.
Yeah, that's. I think I brought this up when didn't we record Jurassic Park about 2 years ago?
Yeah, we have done a Jurassic Park episode already, yeah. But hey, look, this one's different because that one we went through every part of the film. This is a companion piece.
I remember that was the last time I read the book for that recording. And having Michael Crichton do the screenplay with David Koepp is a good thing. Because David Koepp has been known to literally take the book and put it on the Nazi book burning pile and write his own screenplays. And this was very close. And like Steve said, they've amalgamated characters. They've deleted entire sequences, which were too expensive to film at the time, or they couldn't film. And it sticks very close, but cuts through all of the crap that you don't need in a film version.
Mm.
And it's very, very well adapted. Probably one of the, I'd say, best novelty film adaptations to actually not miss the point of the book, which some adaptations do. Looking at you, The Lost World, 3 years later.
Speaking of Lost World, didn't like Hammond get like the deer to death from Lost World in the
yep.
book? Didn't the Compies get
him? Yeah. Hammond was killed by Compies in the book, and then
how different is that? How
different? But like Crazy. You said, Hammond's a dick, even to his grandkids. Yeah. And yeah, there's the Lloyd characters amalgamation, like 3 or 4 different characters, but it works from a logistical storytelling point of view, visually storytelling anyway.
Yeah, I think if they'd stuck to Hammond the way he was in the book, it just wouldn't work with the plot of the film that they went for.
You need a grandfatherly visionary character, don't you?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you can kind of, like, when you watch the film, you can kind of see the kind of man that he is, but you can see that there's some kind of love behind those business eyes of his, and you know, there is a bit of care for other people, and that does work. Which, if he was just a dick, then no one could relate to him, could they? No one would particularly care whether he lived or died.
Like, it feels like because like a big part of this film is hubris and, you know, capitalist hubris, right? It feels like all of those elements were given to the lawyer, and it feels like Hammond is like almost above reproach, right? Like, he's reckless, but he's being reckless in pursuit of a sincerely held vision, which is to thrill people with this exciting new dinosaur science.
I never quite bought into his vision, though. Like, I mean, obviously, yeah, he was a caring capitalist, but like, I was more kind of on Gennaro's side in the scene where they're talking about how, you know, Jurassic Park's, you know, our attractions are going to be for everyone. And it's like all these like low income families are going to fuck off to Costa Rica to see dinosaurs. It's like, how? Coupon day. It's like the fucking Tesco Club card vouchers to go to the fucking is Nublar. It's like, I don't, you know, fucking Woucher or something. It's like, I don't think it's going to happen. Like, fair play, John, you know, that's a lovely vision to have. But yeah. Part of me feels like he didn't even mean it. I feel like he still knows, like, yeah, this is going to be a cash cow. He's a capitalist.
He says, our park will not only cater to the super rich. And the way he says it is like he's accepting that it's for rich people.
Yeah.
But it won't only be for the super rich.
It
comes across to me as naivety, though, more than it does him being a bastard.
Like, I'm going to say this because it looks good in a press release. And, you know, yeah.
I think, didn't Spielberg go on an interview, or it might be on one of the DVD features, that he adapted Hammond as the new age Walt Disney.
Like, I can see that.
The way Disneyland was, you know, marketed and available to all, and certain brackets of, you know, admission fees and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, and the way they covered up all those deaths as well. It's quite similar.
Yep.
Yeah. A really important aspect from the book that came over perfectly and fully intact was the science part. And, like, that's what Michael Crichton's known for, is writing really realistic feeling and compelling science-ish based storylines. And, like, a lot of people at the time came away from Jurassic Park thinking, so are they going to do that then? Because that would be cool. Like, they should actually do that. Because it feels really, really believable and really compelling, the way they explain bringing back the dinosaurs, which is super important because it's a bonkers concept that you just buy straight away because of the way it's written and the way they explain it to you is great. It's so well done.
I feel like there was a 5-year period after that film came out where I really believed, any moment now, they're going to set on BBC News round that, we've got a T-Rex. It's like, oh shit. And where's it going to be? Where do I have to go? Where do I have to drag my parents to go see this T-Rex? And obviously, it's a shame.
They do kind of call it out in the book that, it's impossible to clone a dinosaur from ancient DNA that doesn't. But in the film, it's a very po-faced look at it.
It's very, like, almost very simplistic way of.
Yeah, it's technobabble to the eighth degree. But it works on a storytelling level. But the book calls it out, and the film simplifies it very well about the frog DNA. But there are numerous different DNAs that they splice to get the dinosaur to appear as you would consider a dinosaur. And it's one of the best lines in the last Abomination movie, where Wu says, we've never had dinosaurs. We have people's perceptions of dinosaurs creating a lab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's kind of a line from the book that says, these aren't real dinosaurs. These are what people expect to see from various existing species now.
Is what people saw in Dinosaurus and thought, this is a dinosaur.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay to see this dinosaur, like, without feathers.
didn't they, like, a couple of years back, some scientists reverse engineer a chicken embryo to turn on genes that have been turned off due to evolution?
Don't know.
Like the genome or something. I'm sure I read that somewhere.
That's more than likely.
They were turning genes on that had been turned off for millions of years and turning them back on and seeing what happens. It's like, we all know where this goes, guys.
When was Dolly the sheep?
I was going to mention this.
Oh, Dolly, how is she doing?
98, wasn't it?
Was it late 90s?
It was about the time of, like, New Labour and everything was great. We've got Dolly, we've got Tony Blair.
Things can only get better. Look at this, we've made two sheep and they look the same. The future is bright.
The future is orange. Fucking Tony Blair.
We've got D-Ream and Dolly and Oasis.
I feel like the cloning thing, like, it really, cloning felt like this kind of, you know, like bioengineering and cloning and stuff felt like it was going to be a thing. And then it just wasn't a thing. And I came out of it like, I want to be a JP scientist and I hope they actually bring dinosaurs. It's like we didn't fucking watch the film. Like, the film's message is super clear.
Yeah.
But we all wanted it to be true because it was just so exciting and compelling.
Dolly the sheep was born on the 5th of July, 1996.
96? Okay. Is that early?
Oh, it was her birthday the other day. Should we miss her?
And she survived until the 14th of February, 2003.
Aw. Aw. Poor Dolly.
I don't know what the average lifespan of a sheep is, so I don't know if that's sad or not.
She died so young.
Mate. Me neither. But before we get into our favourite scene of the movie, I think we just should have a quick chat about the cast of the film, because they did manage to round up a great bunch of actors for the film. And there's no point in talking about Jeff Goldblum, because he just does Jeff Goldblum. It's exactly the same thing that we do every single time we touch on Jeff Goldblum films. But does anyone disagree with that sentence?
Goldblum's like a force of nature. Yes. I love him.
Yeah.
But I guess the only thing that you can say about his character in Jurassic Park is the fact that he does have the best lines.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Although, I mean, to me, Bob Peck, you know, Roll Doom, Clever Girl is just like an all-time great line. It's just so, like, it's a complete admission of defeat, but it's like Tim actually appreciating the savvy of these predators that he's hunted, that he just, that, you know, you outsmarted me, you know, checkmate, fair play. And I love it. It's so, such an amazing line.
Like, that was a fundamental great point of the film and the book, which the new movies have completely forgotten about, that these are living, breathing animals.
No, Chris, they're horror movie icons. Yeah, they're like Freddy Krueger.
They run and eat you. You have to run and blow them up.
They're Looney Tunes.
Yeah, basically. Oh, God. Fuck. Jesus Christ.
I know what you're thinking.
That fucking auction scene. Jesus Christ.
The auction scene where the Velociraptor looks right into the camera lens.
And the tail goes up and there's almost a smirk and it's just like, fuck off. But anyway, Jurassic Park 1.
Say Jurassic Park 1, please. Don't cheapen it.
Sorry. Jurassic Park, the
Jurassic
OG.
World, Origins.
Jurassic Legacy Park. Jurassic Park.
They will do that, Chris. They will do that. They will rebrand the DVD.
We know what happened. But to treat them like animals and like was different, because the monster movies that we've had before then are just like, run away, run away. These were actually living, breathing animals. And to have people appreciate them and try and guess what they're going to do next, like Rich said, Muldoon the Game Warden, Ian Malcolm, the other behavioural specialists around the park, was great. And it went into the Lost World as well, and then quickly got forgotten about after that one.
The other scene I think about as well is when Newman's trying to get away in the Jeep, and I don't remember the name of the dinosaur that gets him, the one with the collar that goes...
Dilophosaur.
Yeah, that dinosaur also, that scene is frightening because it's an animal that's behaving unpredictably. It doesn't just kill him straight away. Like, it behaves really animalistically, and it's really unpredictable. And he throws the stick for it, and it just watches the stick and doesn't chase it. And, yeah, it's great.
It's almost kind of bird-like. He's playing with the prey. That's why people think love the Dilophosaur. He seems very, you know, unassuming and kind of friendly. Lovely little bird calls that she makes. Mm-hmm. And then
horrific.
Full-blown terror.
Yeah, but we've all had those moments in zoos where you see a tiger or something go for the glass or something, or for another tiger, and you realise, fuck, they've got some energy and some fucking weight behind them. Got no fucking chance. And to have the Dilophosaurus be absolutely terrifying along with the Velociraptors is just... Those two dinosaurs made the T-Rex just look like... The T-Rex is the T-Rex, but those are terrifying because they are the height of a human, the arms are positioned like a human, and they are terrifyingly quick and calculating.
And the fact that you're blinded when you're being eaten alive as well.
Oh, I know,
like,
yeah.
Like, just... is it maybe a good thing, or is it way worse?
I mean, what's it like, an anesthesia type effect or something? So,
but
the way he gets spat at, and I'm pretty sure that's not kicked in by the time he gets eaten in the Jeep.
Yeah, no, I think it just blinds you. I don't think there's any anesthesia going on there. Also, I'm going to say it's probably a lot worse.
Yeah. Your senses are just heightened to the shit. It's like every ounce of pain and like just everything has just gone through the roof. It's like, no.
Just that hissing and, oh, God. And the rattling of the frill was, I remember going like, what the fuck is this? Like, what the
hell? Yeah. So cool.
It just speaks to the primal parts of your brain that tells you to just run or freeze.
And there's a part of the conversation we had in our first Jurassic Park episode of a fact that it was probably Chris who said it about where he slips on the rocks and you get the cartoon.
That was Rich that said that.
Tied to the thing there and then put down this thing here and then pull it back up.
That was Rich that said that.
And like I was waiting this time, but I want to rewatched it recently, and I was waiting for it. I was waiting for it.
Definitely there.
Now, I've always read that scene as the raincoat in, it's the trousers or something, like running on the wet rocks.
Mm.
But if you watch it, his clothes haven't touched the rocks at that point. It's just his office shoes, maybe. I don't know, but it's very much. It can't have been a coincidence or accident. The editors and sound editors and Foley artists must have gone, that's funny, leave it in. I don't know.
Maybe it kind of like having that cartoon sound kind of like puts you at like a full sense of security and obviously makes the horror that comes ahead like so much worse. Because you're like, oh, this is really, he fell on the rocks. Batman. And then like, it's like horrifying.
I don't know that I've ever noticed that.
Yeah. Sound
but
like.
I was the same as you, Steve.
It's very subtle, and until someone points it out to you, you're like, you just ruined my fucking life.
Like the hands bouncing the tail and the raptor.
Yeah,
the
that's a classic.
Like, let me just take care of that. We won't CGI that. We won't CGI that later.
Yeah. No one will notice.
Surely that shoe's squeaking on wet rock. Sorry, I just listened to it on my phone.
That's how I've always looked at it.
It's possible.
It's possible, but, you know, nothing in a film is there by accident, so maybe they heard it and thought, we'll leave it in, because, yeah, it sounds like a slipping sound. I don't know.
I feel like them just doing, like, a fat guy sound, which is mean.
Could be, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, look at him.
Well, it was the 90s, wasn't it?
Exactly. It wasn't.
You can't expect to be fat in a film and not get the piss taken out of you.
Yeah,
exactly. But is there anyone else from the cast that you guys want to particularly have a chat about before we move on?
Sam Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before he made it big. Yep.
It was just like so like this guy in the film before he was Sam Jackson. It was like, oh, it's just this guy.
Yeah.
It's like, and then suddenly it's like.
Chain smoking engineer guy.
Then Tarantino found him and boom, there it is.
You still see him in the film. You don't think it's Sam Jackson.
No,
it's this guy.
Because he's not playing a Sam Jackson shouty, you know, African-American character yet. He's just playing a computer dude that drinks coffee and chain smokes.
He's great. He's great.
Get these monkey fighting raptors of this Monday to Friday generator room, you know.
The closest he got to was, I hate this hacker crap.
Yeah, because he's always got a fag in his mouth.
Yeah.
It's quite weird to watch this and then go and watch Secret Invasion like 2 days later as well.
Yeah.
You know,
so to de-age him, it's like it messes my head up so bad. So
yeah. And I was thinking that as well because they de-age him in Miss Marvel? They de-age him in?
Yeah, they do, yeah. Captain Marvel.
Mm. And but then I'm thinking, like, when they de-age him in that film, it doesn't look like he looks like in Jurassic Park.
No. He's got two arms, so.
Well, yeah. I mean, Sam Jackson's a legend in whatever he does, so, and he is just as much of a legend in this film as he is in anything else he's done in his career. So, I mean, I think he's probably one of the only actors who can look back on his catalogue of films he's done and some. Do you know what? They're all right. Mm. There's not really any turkeys in that. Yeah. No. Happy with that?
No, I guess not.
Other than Sam Jackson, I'd probably say, obviously, this was an important film to me. Formative, you know, it played to my dinosaur fascination, but I also feel like it came at a time where probably I developed a bit of a crush for Laura Dern.
Who didn't?
There you go. I'm saying. Putting it out there.
Ellie Sattler in this film, 1993, and like very feminist, which is also a big change from the book as well.
Hell yeah. yeah.
But like done, feminism done in a way that is way more deft than a lot of films these days manage to pull it off. Like,
yeah.
It feels completely believable and sincere, and her character is fantastic.
Yeah.
I think she even says, like, that there's a line in the film where I think Hammond's like,
eat man. I'm like, fuck yeah.
Love it.
but then Hammond's like, I think like the men should go, right? And then she gets all cross and is like, we'll talk about misogyny during emergency environments when I get back.
It's awesome. It's
The way they did that, I think, was the generation gap, because everyone's grandparent has always said something like really grand or dad, granddad, like really. I get that. But in the book, she's a student.
Yeah, but, yeah. I remember, because like Alan is like way more her senior, isn't he? He's like bearded, barrely bloke, isn't he?
They're not a couple. It's not even implied in the book at all. But the film comes out and you cast two people. You need a bit of a will they, won't they atmosphere going on. So, but yeah, the film is very, very progressive for the early 90s.
Yeah.
Extremely so.
It's actually kind of crazy how progressive it is. It does still surprise me, because I do think like a lot of the films around that time, you go back, you're like, ooh. But it really just
plays it so well. Yeah. She's forward thinking. She doesn't have to ask permission before she does shit.
Yeah.
Because although Alan Grant's leading the dig, she is still a respected person of her field within that dig. And it's just brilliant. And I love her and Sam Neill together. I think they are just brilliant together.
I'm so glad they got together in whatever the last one was. I don't remember what it's called. I don't remember. See how much it matters. Just like,
it's called the Locusts.
Yeah, it's called Jurassic.
I just remember that Ian slid into her DMs. That was like, no! like, don't do this to these characters I love, you bastards.
I just think that we would be amiss to not bring up the actors who played the kids, Joseph Mazzello and Ariana Richards, because
fantastic.
Whenever you see kids in a film that is to do with this kind of thing, you're just like, oh, don't put kids in it. But the way he cast really honest, genuine actors to embody the parts. I'm not too sure why they switched the age of the kids. I'm not entirely sure, because in the book, Tim's the eldest. Maybe it was that moment where let's make it the older sister, or it could be the cast. I don't know. No one's ever said anything about it, but the kids are great, and they symbolize the children of the audience that would be watching this film. You have one who's terrified. And the younger brother is terrified, but also completely awestruck at the same time. Even in the kitchen, he's terrified, and you feel that terror. And you experience every major event through their eyes, and it's just great. Never once do I watch this and think, oh, kids, just shut the fuck up.
No, sure. And the ages were swapped to the kids, but also in the book, Tim was the computer whiz as well.
Yes,
so they flipped the personalities around, which is, you know, another example, because, you know, hacking's boy stuff. But in this film, it's Lex who does it.
She knows Linux.
She does.
I think Lex has definitely got a Steam Deck, so, you know. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Did you see that she recently recreated the Jello shot?
No.
Was it Vanity Fair or Vogue?
Yeah, Ariana Richards is a treasure. It's amazing.
Have you guys seen her artwork?
Yes.
Oh, my God. No. It is.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Photo quality oil paints. Oh, my God. It is just stunning. It is beautiful stuff. Like,
yeah.
I love that they both gone on to better things. Obviously, Joseph Mazzello's still acting, but I think she's gone on to art and charity work, I believe, or something similar. And it's just, don't have any problem.
I think what I loved about the kids in that film, like, because I think there is that thing a lot of the time where Hollywood execs think that, like, kids want to see kids in films. And I think it's not necessarily the case. I think kids want to see cool grown ups they aspire to be. But I feel like the kids in this film were really good analog for kids that wanted to see this film, because when there I was, like Tim, a dinosaur nut, and I had a sister who was like probably a similar number of years my elder, so I did kind of see myself and my sister in that film, and it's like, it's kind of relatable even at that age. And I love that.
I'm doing the chalk and cheese characterizations, and it's the same in the book. Tim is telling, in the film, he's telling people what the dinosaurs are.
Mm.
That was me. I was obsessed with all things sci-fi and, like you said, dinosaurs. My brother was a sports nut into football, and my mum wouldn't know a T-Rex from a brachiosaur. So I was that annoying kid at home, just like you. And we all had that where you are that. And then finally you see a film that's for you and you're just like, yeah, give me some more of that, please.
We should jump to our listener feedback that we received from Carl. And this is what he had to say about Jurassic Park.
Hello, Wolfie Podcast. Just a quick recollection about Jurassic Park, the first movie. It was a film that I saw at the cinema, and I watched it without reading any reviews and stuff like that. It was one of them films where if you saw the trailer, you more or less saw the best parts of the film, which was a bit of a letdown, really. The glass of water vibrating with the Tyrannosaurus Rex coming up close was really good. The guy getting eaten while he's sitting on a daddy. And a nice Diplodocus poo joke as well, I think, if I remember rightly. Brilliant performances from Jeff Goldblum and Dickie Attenborough. But I wish I was watching The Fly, really, halfway through. It came out thinking it was a bit of a kids' movie. But it launched a great franchise, and I haven't really watched any more of the others, so not really much help, but loving the podcast. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Well, I did not see that coming at all.
I want this guy to send one in every single film that we talk about.
He used the divvy term Diplodocus. I love it. It's so great. But I love that he did.
We've been recording for 57 minutes now, and he just blew us out of water.
I'd rather be watching The Fly.
I'd rather be watching The Fly, really.
It was Diplodocus Dunny gagging it all.
Sincerely, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for saying that in.
Ian Malcolm snapped that raptor's arm. Like, it was just,
I don't know. Like, so comments quite controversial there. You know, you'd rather be watching The Fly.
I feel like that was a bit. I don't feel like it was a good review. Like,
I don't agree with him at all, but it was brilliant. I loved it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Carl, for sending that in. I think you've just made everyone's night.
Sincerely, Carl, thank you so much. That was great.
And he is a podcast host himself of the Bite High No Limit podcast, which is kind of like a retro technology podcast, which he also does a lot of interviews with Teletext and CFAX people and things like that.
Okay, we need to get on that.
I see a collab coming up, Jason.
Please go and check out his podcast. I've listened to a couple of them, and they are quite they're very interesting and informative.
Is he as brutally honest to the nose as he was with this?
No, he's not actually. So. Okay, well, I think we've recovered from Carl's comments there, so we can get into our favourite scene of the film. And let's go to we'll go to Steve.
I liked it when a lawyer got eaten off the dunny. but the best scene in the... Well, I don't know. It's really hard to choose. I feel like I say that every time. But the kitchen scene is the one that really stands out for me.
This was my choice as well.
Mm. Yeah. It really, really shows off that balance of CGI and practical effects. And again, Steven Spielberg, he knows how to create tension in a scene. Mm-hmm. Look out for this Stevie Spielberg guy. I can see him going places because he seems to know what he's doing. Mm. terrifying scene, really well done. It's got that, it's got everything. It's got the really good pacing, it's got the really good tension. You really understand what's going on. You know where you are in that kitchen the whole time. You know where the velociraptors are the whole time. It's just incredibly well done. It's a masterclass in, you know, tension, horror. It's great. It's fantastic. And the bit where it's you think the velociraptor is going to get him, but it's actually a reflection is great. Because again, they're animals and they're dumb in some ways, right? Yeah.
I mean, I think what I like about that film more so is like where we've had a lot of the film where it's like all being bombastic and, you know, it's been a spectacle and had all this action and everything else. And then we get this scene where it's just like, it's quite quiet, really. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's quite suspenseful in that quietness. You know, there's not a bombastic soundtrack playing in the background. It's, I don't know, it seems quite an enclosed, it's an enclosed experience, isn't it? And with those factors together and the heightened emotions, I guess, of like imagining yourself in this situation with these two raptors in this kitchen and being one of these children. Just absolutely terrifying, but also absolutely memorizing it all at the same time.
It's also like the raptors are in their environment now as well, because they're supposed to be safe. Mm-hmm. They're indoors. They're supposed to be safe. And now there are raptors from, you know, dinosaur times in a kitchen with ladles and frying pans and stainless steel and shit. And like, that's maybe the first time that happens, I think, really, in that film.
Still one of the best transitions in cinema as well. Let's hope they don't learn how to open doors.
Oh, yeah.
And then you see the door handle squeak, and you're like, oh, my fucking God.
A little quiet bit. I just so, it's so just like, oh, God, it's just terrifying.
Yeah.
That's when the film kind of almost feels a bit like a slasher. It feels like there's the killer in the house, and it's the final girl trying to, like, just that cat and mouse through the house upstairs into a different room, but it's all within the confines of this, you know, visitors attraction, kitchen, you know.
And there's only one way out as well. And the other raptor, this is where you see him the first time and only, or second time in the film, pack hunting, where one is covering the exit and entrance.
That's messed up.
And the other one is walking around and you say, oh my God, this is insane.
So messed up. Yeah.
And there's that little moment where they kind of fall out with each other as well, which is really good.
Yeah. And the fact is, because it kind of like, it's that whole like reveal as well, where you feel like, okay, one's opened the door and then suddenly realize, oh shit, there's actually three. It's like, it's like, ah, shit.
And also you see the big claw tapping on the floor, and that's been set up right at the beginning of the film where he explains to the kid what the raptor does with the claw. So you know exactly how much danger they're both in. Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
You don't see Alan say they communicate with their claws. That was a complete fucking curveball from the director to the audience going, yeah, they can communicate by tapping as well. Like, get the fuck out. What the fuck? Like, just tapping and communicating. Is just...
Well, wasn't that just a person with like a raptor shoe on or something?
I hope so.
I'm not entirely sure. They did have raptor suits for the scene where the raptors are standing on... Not running, I don't think. But as I was standing full motion, I think when one of the raptors goes up and spits into the air, I think that's a guy in a raptor suit, I believe.
Really?
And in the Muldoon stalking scene, I believe it's a... Because it's more forgiving in a jungle. As for the running scene with between the legs, I don't know how they got that shot. I've never even thought about that until now, actually.
Yeah, because they get that shot right behind the legs when, you know, when Tim's running towards the walking freezer and he's kind of sliding on the ice. Everyone feels like that's a purely practical effect because they're right behind the hills.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
It's never occurred to me, actually, to be honest.
I noticed as well, you saw about the Muldoon scene, you can kind of tell it's practical because you always notice with the raptor when it's like just going to town on Muldoon, like the mouth is quite fixed. It always looks like it's a practical thing. Mm. It's not very animated. I don't think it's obviously a shonky visual effect. It's just...
Pretty sure it's a guy in a suit. Yeah. Which is really fascinating. If you just look up velociraptor suit and everyone will know what I'm talking about, it's just insane. The guy's sort of like crouched up, like in this kind of like crouched stance on stilts, and it's just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, sod that.
And also, has anyone ever noticed how quiet the pans are that they cook with in that pan?
No.
Ever since I was a kid, when the raptor jumps up on top of the worktop, all the pans fly off the worktop and don't make a sound when they hit the floor.
Mm. No sound. Mm.
It was 2 or 3 years ago I noticed it, and or maybe someone spoke about it on some video, and I was just like, what the fuck? Like, your brain for some reason fills in that mistake, and it's like, ugh.
I never noticed that.
I don't know.
No, not did I, but we'll do next time.
And it's weird.
Yeah. There's one bit where stuff goes crashing down, but maybe that's just a bit of the
There's
label.
Several parts, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe that just gets lost in there and you don't really notice.
That's another flawless part of CG is the raptors jumping onto those worktops, because it's flawless, and it's so... I don't know how I achieved it in this day, because you've got like complex keyframing and... motion control has to be done on that scene to get all of those composites, and it's just mind blowing.
Computers, I believe, is how they pulled that off.
Just, it's astounding. Even now, you look at it, you're
it like, is it is incredible. Like, we keep saying, this film really holds up, and that's correct. It really does hold up. But like, I feel like that's not the right way. Like, it doesn't just hold up. Like, it this film's 30 years old, and it does not look 30 years old. Nope. It looks fucking incredible still. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy how good it looks.
Okay, Chris, what's your favourite scene?
Each one of us are going to mention a scene that we all find mind-blowing, but as much as I love the achievement of the T-Rex scene and the fact that they did a CG rain, CG car, CG kids and T-Rex all in the same one shot is astounding. To me, this is going to maybe be a left-field scene. It's a very low-key one, and it's the first time you see the Brachiosaur on the Jeeps. I mentioned it earlier, the way it's shot at like knee length. You're looking up as they're looking up, and it's out of frame, and it's as if the director can't get this real animal. Even when they're filming, they're treating them as real animals. They're not even being rendered yet. And it's just a glorious scene. Those glorious John Williams strings come in really slowly. They build up. It kind of gives you goosebumps and makes you feel really emotional. And you're seeing this amazing thing, an achievement of genetic engineering. No one's seen a dinosaur ever in the history of mankind until humans come along and develop this technology. And you're seeing it with them for the first time and from a low angle and almost like a child looking up at an adult who's looking up at a dinosaur that no one's seen before. And it's a beautiful scene. It never gets talked about enough. It's a simple scene. It's a low-key scene. Nothing happens, but you see dinosaurs for the first time in the film, and it's gloriously shot and framed and scored and even acted. Like, you believe that these characters are seeing this thing for the first time. All of them are in such awe. And it's glorious. And it's the first dinosaur shot of the entire film. Well, apart from the glimpse of the raptor in the beginning.
I don't think that's left field at all. I think that's a great choice. That's iconic. That shit's iconic. Laura Dern rising out of the Jeep and taking the sunglasses off in disbelief. Like,
amazing.
Yeah. Magic movie moment, that. Which they tried to replicate. Like, they kind of did a nod to it in the latest Jurassic Park film. And did anyone notice that?
Yep.
It's like when she was looking at all the corn that had been eaten by the locusts, she rose out of the Jeep and took her sunglasses. And I was like, fuck off, film. Don't do that. You leave that scene alone.
There are certain parts of that fucking movie that just pissed me off.
But
you have Alan Grant and you have Ellie Sattler. And where do you put them? In a fucking cornfield with locusts.
Yeah.
They're the legacy characters of the IP. That's
But then the fucking T-Rex walks past a fountain, which is circular-shaped, opens its mouth...
Oh, no. Oh, no. Yeah, no, I know.
And it's the Jurassic Park logo. And you're like, get fucked. Actually, get fucked. It's almost as if...
I shouldn't have brought up the latest film. I'm sorry.
It's a sore point. It's a very sore point.
You can see them going to the T-Rex as if it was an actual actor. Right, now walk behind the thing, and you know the logo that's everywhere. Mimic that. Fuck off. Yeah, so... I just
great choice of scene, Chris, in the original Jurassic Park from 1993.
I mean, was that unscripted, that scene? I can't, for some reason, something my brain's telling me
no,
that it was a bit.
The dinosaur did improv, I think.
Yeah.
entire scene.
Fucking hell. I'm not entirely sure. There are different takes, and Spielberg's never released deleted scenes. And if you watch the trailers, some of the deleted scenes appear in the trailers because the trailers are stitched together so early during editing and principal photography. And there's a deleted scene in a car where she's talking about the plants and where it was found and what it is.
That's right, yeah.
But the scene, I love that scene because Ellie's the last one to see it because she's so enthralled in this extinct piece of plant that she's got in front of her. And the book is very similar. In actual fact, it is almost identical. They all notice differently at different times and they're all speechless. And I love that scene where it's no one says a word to each other. And again, Spielberg keeps your attention. No one says a single word for about 3 minutes. And it pans up and they're all staring. And you just slowly hear these footsteps. And then you slowly hear these noises. You look up and there it is. This dinosaur. It's just glorious.
And that music too, man. Like, Jason, when you piped in the trailer, like, just hearing that music swell is like... Yeah. Goosebump time.
I still get like a little bit of my throat.
Second best piece that John has done, is it, apart from Indiana Jones.
My favorite scene is definitely the one where the personal assistant gets cruelly killed by some pterosaurs and a mosasaurus in a veiled example of misogyny by the director. Oh, sorry, that's Jurassic World. Jurassic Park would be. I'm going to be unoriginal. I'm going to say the whole T-Rex escape the paddock scene, everything about that, it almost feels like that's where the movie kind of excels, because even though you see, like, you kind of get the raptor dining scene, it's all very kind of hidden. The Dilophosaurus is the nearest you get to an actual moment, but when the T-Rex, for the moment it eats the goat to the wires, the cables pinging off the electric fences, and the T-Rex has that moment where it's revealed and it just lets out that roar. And I remember even now, like, the cinema just fucking shaking. And I was just like, I didn't know how much I was excited and terrified, because I just knew, oh shit, shit's bad now. There's no power in this park. This T-Rex is now just roaming amongst the people. Like, it's got free reign. You know, the raptor's already out at this point as well. And it's just absolutely terrifying. Like, you really, again, going back to what I said about with the kids, you really, as a kid, they were like that, they were the analog in the film, and you felt every moment they were in this upturned explorer, just this T-Rex just toying with it like it was a die-cast model, and they're inside it just fearing for their lives, and you've got Alan and Ian just watching it. And the rain the whole time, the pitter-patter of just raindrops. Whether it was now with my like little surround sound at home or even in the cinema at the time, that whole scene is just like sensory overload. Just the rain's constantly... And just the roar, the footsteps, the mud, the squelching. Everything about it is just overwhelming and scary. And it's just... There's so many moments. Like, the moment that explorer flips over to the flares when Ian's running, trying to lure the T-Rex away, to Gennaro getting ragdolled. It's just so much going on in that scene. But it's so beautifully done that it's not like a lot of films nowadays where it's hard to tell what's going on. It's just slow, methodical. Every shot matters. You know where everything is at the time, the geography of the scene, where the kids are, to Ian and... Alanar, to where the T-Rex is. It just is it's a masterclass of filmmaking. And obviously I say that now as an adult where I kind of appreciate that stuff more. But even as a kid, it was just enthralling. And I appreciated it even then in quite a similar way to what I do now. I didn't just think, oh yeah, dinosaur. Yeah, it really appreciated the craft of it. And it just hooked me. And I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. I was so excited that I didn't care. I was scared. I didn't want to leave. I was just like, I was here for it. And yeah, to me, that scene is just fucking amazing. And it still holds up as like one of the best scenes in film history, in my opinion. I still get excited now. If I put the Blu-ray in, I'm always still waiting for that scene, because that's when the film just starts to like, oh shit, like stuff's gone bad, and it's just so good. It's fantastic scene.
And no music either.
No music at all. It's just, I didn't say that. It's like, oh shit.
It's literally scored with rain. Tension. Rain is your backbeat. And then it starts with those cables being ripped and that electric sound. And then like almost like laser beams.
Yeah.
And then you just, the shit just hits the fucking fan.
It
has
creaking, like the supports where it's just like the wind swaying and it's just, oh, it's awful.
The goat's so gone.
The poor goat's gone.
That's right.
The goat's gone.
And then it lands on the window.
With a satisfying, meaty squeak.
And if you have like a good sound system as well, they really emphasize that goat leg because it's like, boom, it's just like, I don't appreciate that. But
and the lawyer runs to the toilet. When you gotta go, you gotta go.
Yeah.
I can think of more places to run, though. I just like saying the Lord's Prayer while sitting in the toilet. Like, yeah, because that small shack is not going to protect you from anything.
It also just, like, the peril just keeps coming as well, right? Because they get squished into the mud, and then the T-Rex is, like, nosing the car around, and they've got to move around the opposite side of the car, and then they get shoved off the edge into the paddock, and then they're hanging off the cable, but now the car's coming off at them and is going to drop down, and they've got to swing left and right. And then the scene ends with them on the ground, and the car, like, falls on top of them, and it's not over until that point. It just keeps going and going and going, and, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, before we have a quick chat about where we want to see the Jurassic Park franchise, the Snow World
franchise
in the future, we should just give our verdicts and our scores for Jurassic Park and get it up onto our board. So this is the interesting. Will it get the full marks? Will it be the first one to grab those 10 out of 10s?
Oh, ye of little faith.
Well, Chris, okay. Come on then. Give us your verdict on Jurassic Park and your overall score of the film.
I have a soft spot for it and always have and always will. It's, I think me and Rich have spoken years before, quite a few years ago, that it's almost like our generation's Jaws.
I love how you just said a soft spot, like it's the 2004 Punisher film. It's just like, yeah, I mean, Jurassic Park.
Sorry.
I love the way you understand it. It's so great, but continue.
That was just a bad word use on my point. I do apologise.
I don't care what they say about this film. I like it.
I respect how understated that was.
I just have the utmost respect and love for it and always will do. And I'm going to do a Spinal Tap and put it up to 11. It's one louder.
Ooh, you can't do that. Breaks the rules.
No, breaking the rules, man. Breaking the rules.
But it's 10. It has to be a 10. There's no way out of it. It's just going to be a 10 for me.
Well, 10. I mean, I can't not give it a 10. It's a 10. I think the only thing that I don't like about this film is, you know when the shotgun jams?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's clear at all, right? Did you ever find that when you used to watch this film?
No, I don't mean actually now, yeah.
It's they're holding it off with the shotgun, but then they can't shoot the shotgun anymore because it jams, and I feel like that's not clearly communicated to the audience. So yeah, 7 then. No, not really. 10. 10, 10, 10.
Now you bring that up, actually, I completely forgot about that. The raptor scene in the air conditioning duct when all you hear is Hammond's walkie-talkie radio audio of what's going on. The audience has no idea what's going on. You just hear the gun go off and then they run.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, what the fuck's going on? Sorry, I completely forgot about that.
And one of my favourite facts about this film as well is when Lex falls through the vent and the raptor's below her and she looks up for a second, that's digital face.
Yeah, it's scary.
Because that's not really her. That's a stunt double. Anyway,
Some dude.
And that was done better here than it was done in Titanic with Leo and Kate a few years later as well.
Yeah.
What scene do they replace faces in that?
When they're running from the water up the corridor.
Oh, really?
It's two stunt doubles and it's really dodgily CG'd their faces from a different scene onto their faces.
It'd never be as bad as the Kate Bosworth surfing movie Blue Crush, though. That was terrible.
Mate, you know what? I've never seen that film.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that you went to the cinema to see it.
I don't know why I saw it in the cinema. Her face was like 20 frames ahead of her. It was not right. It was like, nah. Yeah. Still.
God.
This technology is still too young and underdeveloped. this bad surfing film.
Okay, Rich, what's your verdict on your score, man?
It's a 10. Of course it is. It's Jurassic Park. It's not just a film I still love now. Again, it was just it's just a damn important film. I hold this in my top three of all time. Just films that matter to me so much. I'll never not love it. Shaped a lot of my film-going tastes, loves, all of that stuff. It just came at the right time. Like so many things we still cherish today. It was just, we were lucky enough that it happened when it happened. And it's yeah, it's not just nostalgia. It is a wonderful, magical film that is very Spielbergian. And yeah, it's got dinosaurs in it. It's just great. Great cast, great action, lovely story, a score that still reduces me to a blubbering mess at times. I remember being at Royal Albert Hall with Chris, kind of a few rows apart.
That was
when they played the film with the orchestra. And I still remember now, like when they were going to the island, and I was just crying my eyes out in the Royal Albert Hall.
For anyone who can experience a film with the soundtrack isolated, and just the sound effects and audio and an orchestra, do it.
Yeah.
No matter what film it is, just do it. It is an experience that you will never forget.
Such a warmth in that score that I love. It's never just like, oh, yeah, it's just epic. It's like it's always warmth to it. Like the main Jurassic Park theme is just like it's like a nice hug. It just makes me feel happy.
The Jurassic Park, like almost you could say the island theme, the helicopter theme. And then you've got that mid-late bit, which is...
Sorry.
Not so much an action scene, but the dinosaurs don't really have a theme. Their music's like really chaotic sometimes, quite literally on purpose, where it's not noise, it's just very unpredictable, and it's brilliantly scored.
Absolutely. No, I love it. Perfect 10 for me, without a doubt. Amazing film.
Don't let us down, Jason.
I might let you down.
It's not as good as Who Framed Roger Rabbit. 6 out of 10.
How did you know, Rich?
You bastard. It's like
you could read my mind. Okay, Jurassic Park. I can't add anything else that you know, it's an old worn sentence, but it's true. There's nothing else I can add that you guys haven't already said. I don't think I'm going to give it a 10.
There are 10 more things that you can add.
Is there?
Yeah, you can just give it a 10.
You could.
It's really hard because, I don't know. Because you know what I was saying, like when I saw it at the cinema for the first time, and I didn't have that kind of.
You need to be very careful, or else you'll be the only host from tonight on.
Do I do myself a disservice by giving it a 10, even though I didn't have that proper connection to it at the beginning?
You give it the score that you feel in your heart, Jason. Yeah. It's fine, really.
There's no pressure at all for the perfect movie ever to be summoned into.
I'm going to give Jurassic Park a 9.9.
Okay.
Ooh.
Okay, then. Jason, I've decided not to endorse your podcast.
Amazing.
That was fucking brilliant.
I wasn't even set up for that. I was just like, oh, yeah, I see what you did there. That's fantastic.
I love it. That's brilliant.
Amazing. Chris, Jason, you meant to say, so do I.
Damn it, I missed it, didn't I?
And then drive off.
Fucking hell. Yeah. So that's a 39.9 for Jurassic Park. Safely, nice. Safely on the top of the board. It has my top secret off.
Top secret. I believe.
What the fuck were we doing? Giving top secret perfect scores.
We're doing the right thing. That's what we were doing.
Yeah.
Because I believe, off the top of my head, I think they got a 39.6.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we've got Jurassic Park at the top of the board. Happy days. Touched upon it throughout the podcast about the sequels and the Jurassic World films and where they've gone with Jurassic Park, and it's not gone the way in which it should have gone. I mean, we're not happy about how they've handled this continuation of the Jurassic Park story. And I think we're all kind of hoping now that they've done Dominion and this being the third in this Jurassic World trilogy that they're just going to leave it alone now, for now. I mean, they will come back to it at some point. And what do we hope that they are going to do when they do come back to it? Do we want to see them try and continue from where it was Jurassic World left off? Or do we want to see a complete reboot of Jurassic Park? Do they just leave it alone? Do we not need to go back to Jurassic Park that anymore?
That one.
To quote Ian Malcolm, just don't do it. Just leave it. Don't do a prequel.
I can say with whether they could, they didn't think whether they should. So.
Yeah. Don't do a prequel. Don't do a period piece prequel in like the 80s or whatever. Just,
oh no.
just stop. Oh. Just stop this Hollywood machine of don't even think about it. Don't even wish it into the universe.
It sounds really bad and kind of like weird obsessive behavior to be like protective of like a brand and an IP and a logo, but I do take massive umbrage with how they've kind of almost like terraformed the brand to be this Jurassic World now. Like if they do like a Jurassic Park shirt and like Primark or some shit, look at the label, it's Jurassic World. It's like it's all on the Jurassic World banner now. It's like, no, like World is like Park is some like ironic offshoot of it. Like, oh, it's for the old fan, it's for the legacy fans of the IP. You know, it's like, it's just wank. It's corporate wank and I hate it.
Yeah, they've done that at Universal as well, haven't they? Like the whole Jurassic Park rides, they've all been rebranded to World as well.
Bastards! Like, it's like I get it. I know it sounds weird, but yeah, it actually kind of that's actually kind of upset me. Obsessive, deranged. Like I want to just like.
No, but you get like attached to these things that you love, and to see it defaced in a way and stamped on, and then pissed over by people who don't give a shit and don't respect it.
I think it, like, Jurassic Park, the original Jurassic Park still exists and you can still go watch it, and it's still a masterpiece. And I don't necessarily think the original Jurassic Park needs to be protected. I think what makes me cross about it is because this mining for content, like those last three films were dog shit, right? But they made so much money.
Mm-hmm. Like $1.5 billion, wasn't it? For
so Jurassic much
World?
Money. Even though it was generally agreed that they were dog shit, but they don't care because they make a lot of money out of them. And what upsets me about it is that we will never, ever get another Jurassic Park again because they've worked out what the formula is. They've worked out what the algorithm is to make a film that generates a lot of money. And it doesn't matter if it's dog shit. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's upsetting about it. I would love it if they could make another film that was as good as the original Jurassic Park, but they never, ever, ever will, because it would be a risk to do that, to deviate from what they know works.
And that's the sad fact, is these TV shows now that are coming out are just basically retreads, and they're playing it safe, and they're not doing anything different. They're taking people's ideas and putting their own spin on their ideas, but they're not really these new people's ideas. They're just repurposed. And I think with Jurassic World, it just, I don't know. I'm very mixed on the first one. I get what they were doing, but then it just after like 20 minutes, half an hour in, was just like, oh, okay, this is how it is then.
Yeah, I definitely went into that film with like the rose-tinted nostalgia specs. And I think for a while, I even left the cinema thinking that was really good. It was really good. And I just wanted to believe it was good. And then I watched it again. I was like, wank.
The film is designed that way, right? Because there's the guy wearing the T-shirt, and they've got some of the music is in there. They find the old Jeep Wrangler with the night vision goggles in it.
Member berries,
yeah. And
you know, if you're a true Jurassic Park fan, you'll notice this.
Yeah, we've put lots of things in there for the original fans to notice and feel really good about what they noticed. But like, this was kind of a long time ago now, so this was kind of at the beginning of the member berries thing, right? Yeah. So it sort of worked. Like, it kind of worked on me as well. Like, I didn't hate that film either when it came out.
Nah.
In retrospect, particularly in the context of the two films that followed, it's garbage.
I even now probably still enjoy the T-Rex Indominus fight, because it is like a kid smashing two dinosaur toys together. Yeah. I was like, you know what, this is fucking fun as fuck.
The one thing that I will give the first Jurassic World is because the Indominus Rex is a completely engineered dinosaur, right? It didn't exist before. And they say in that film, we're giving people what they want. And it sort of feels kind of meta in that way, that film. And I sort of appreciated that about it.
The public is stupid, basically, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, they want more, so we're going to give them more. It's not a good idea to do that, but that's what they want, so that's what we're going to do, and that's what makes money. And I feel like that sort of meta element was kind of deliberate in that film. And I sort of respect that, but I still wish they just hadn't done it in the first place.
It almost comes from a place of insecurity as well. Like, they know this is shit. So kind of, it's almost like when they kind of say, try to have a good comparison now, but it's almost like they kind of hid behind it with like, we know this film's wank and cynical, but we're going to make it look like we're really smart and we've got a message.
It's your fault, audience. It's your fault.
Yeah.
It's like they became too self-aware of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Jurassic Park 3 is self-aware of what the previous two films were, but the Jurassic World trilogy is just, wait, with Jack Johnson's character, Jake.
Yeah.
He is the embodiment, like Steve said, of the audience who are going in to see it. The people who are now parents taking their kids to go and see this new movie, some of the lines are so cringy and self-aware that you, like, they even call him out, one of the characters even calls him out on it, and you just like, and then it just gets progressively more self-aware and more self-parody as the films go on, especially the third one, just... fuck you.
You love locusts, Chris? Locusts.
The third one is like inept as well. Like, it's bad filmmaking. Like, it's technically a failure. It's really bizarre.
When you see an actor like Sam Neill blatantly bored on set, but then you see him posting on Instagram and Twitter that he's back with these actors that he considers close friends, and then you watch the film and you're just like, dude, you're bored as fuck. What are you doing? Like, I know it's a paycheck, but come on.
You're living an amazing life in New Zealand in a farm with your sheep and your dogs, and it's like...
Yeah, you have the idyllic life, and you fly to the US and the UK to film this film, and then the PR train was phenomenal, because we're like, oh my god, they're all back.
Yeah.
And even Jeff Goldblum, as lovely and charismatic as that dude can flirt with a camera, even his scenes were a bit like, oh, fuck's sake. I came out speechless. I remember saying, like, what even was that? Like,
okay, Colin Trevorrow is a douchebag and should be in movie jail for the rest of his career. I was going to say that. Yes.
I do not begrudge any of them for turning up for what I assume would be a huge, massive, fat paycheck.
I just wish that the writers and the director respected their characters enough from first film and from the first two books, and respected the characterizations enough to give them a respectable role and script treatment. There's too much going on in it that no one knows what to do with each other. Oh,
it did warm my heart a little, but even then it was still a bit like, this is kind of cheap now. Like, they kind of got Alan and Ellie back together after, like, they kind of pulled them apart in Jurassic Park 3, which I felt, it was like your parents splitting up watching.
Yeah.
Ellie and Alan, like, oh, look, Ellie with a kid. Oh, shit, wait, it's not Alan's kid. Motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. The whole arc of the first film is that he hates children, right?
It does, yes.
And but then he learns by the end of the film, he's like, oh, I'm pretty good with kids, actually. Yeah. And, you know, I did a good job there. But then in the last film, they were just like, nah, he was alone the whole time since then. He's sad and alone, and he learned nothing about himself.
You don't want that for characters you care about. You do care about those characters by the end of that film.
Like, even if he wasn't with Ellie in the end, you want Alan Grant to have some kind of happiness.
You do.
It shows like the character's not growing, and it's like you just reset it.
Yeah.
And it's like he's some sad guy that managed to survive this horrible ordeal and has done nothing for like 7 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's sad.
But we're lamenting something that could never have been, because every single executive meeting about this film, it was just people's mouths flapping open with the sound of cash registers. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all it was.
And content.
Content. Legacy IP content. Exactly.
Fucking hell. I hate
exciting
Hollywood.
New content from your favourite IP.
But like we said, we all know in a few years' time, the news will break. And you're like, oh.
Oh, God. So depressing.
I mean, we know that they're going to go back to the Jurassic World Park, whatever thing it is, at some point, right? And I'll go back to my thing that I said in our prepared fast forward predictions for the year about, you know, a prequel TV show of John Hammond and such. And I know you're not that maybe that partial to that idea, Chris, but I think if they want to go and do more with Jurassic Park, that's the way to go.
They can do what they want, but I won't be watching it because I probably, but that's a lie because we all know that we will at some point watch it to either like judge it or see what they're doing with it. Because me and my wife had a conversation, must have been a couple of years ago, that, and it goes to anything. The big cash cows, big, dare I say, franchise, not so much franchises, but film series. You know for a fact that if you make a shit Bond or Indiana Jones movie or Star Wars movie or Jurassic Park movie, people will go and see it.
Mm.
It is a guaranteed success, depending on if it's shit, moderately shit, or batshit or shit. Just people will see it. It will earn a fuck ton of money because those films are inherently bums on seats. People our age, a bit older, will go and see it just because of the brand association. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And I can sit here and say, I won't watch the prequel series, but I probably will at some point watch the 10-part Amazon fucking whatever shit company Hammond makes it.
It's just called Hammond, as it were, yeah. Because that's how they work. Yeah. The John Hammond. Because
I'm sure many, many children and teenagers want to see the origin of John Hammond, the Santa Claus dinosaur clone man.
This is how he gets his cane. This is it.
Yeah,
he gets his limp. Yeah. It's like, it's
you know what? You know what I want to see? I don't want to see John Hammond origins. I want to see the fucking lab where countless fucking people get eaten by things that they don't understand what they fucking are making.
I'd watch that.
Right? And then that age-old gag, isn't it? Like, bring on another minion. Get in there. Why? Because I'm richer than you and no more than you. Get in there now. And I just see them checking off all these like scientists that are just being killed by various different species of dinosaur. That's entertaining. Well, not entertaining, but
sticking with this like prequel John Hammond thing, right? But do you think it would be better if like it was the book version of Hammond instead of like the film version of Hammond?
No, they want to keep it within continuity within the wider Jurassic World universe.
The film version of Hammond is also a lot more interesting than the book version of Hammond, who was basically just a villain. I quite like the idea of a 10-part TV show, but it would have to be done extremely well. Mm-hmm. And I would watch it if it was done cleverly. Like they should call it like Flea Circus or something and get really cerebral about it. Like,
the Flea Circus on Petticoat Lane.
And like, yeah, I could see it kind of working. I would give that a chance, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what film I've always wanted to see? Or miniseries that I've always wanted to see?
Oh,
Michael Crichton's original sequel, The Lost World, is a really dark fucking espionage book.
Mm-hmm. The espionage, film love it.
Completely missed the fucking point. We all know that Michael Crichton didn't want to write the book. He was asked by the publishers and Universal and Amblin, could you write a book so we can make a sequel? He declined until they offered him a fat fucking paycheck, and he was like, okay, I'll resurrect a character that I killed off in the first book. Right, Malcolm's still alive. Okay, the book is really good. And it's got Lewis Dodgson in it, who no one cares about.
See, no one cares. What?
Yeah, exactly. And he goes to Isla Sauna, and Indiana sent a team to take dinosaurs off the island. But Lewis Dodgson goes in to sample DNA, and then the Lost World movie happens, and you're like, what the fuck is this? Like, what the hell? These characters are brilliantly written in the book. He maybe didn't want to write the sequel book, but it's fucking great.
Mm.
And then the film happens, and you're just like, wow, we have a teenager who's an acrobat, and we have a wisecracking...
She was cut from the team?
Yeah.
God, don't. Hey, and you! We have to turn it's me. It's like... Yeah.
And we like... have the fantastic, fantastic Richard Schiff as Eddie.
Oh, poor Eddie.
And... He's the best character in the film, and he's the best character in one of the best characters in the book, and he's the best part of the entire film. And The Lost World would make an amazing either miniseries or I think it's been adapted into comic book series in the '90s or something, but the film we got was nothing like the book.
Yeah.
And it was a pure espionage thriller that was just gloriously violent.
That sounds great.
Mm.
Yeah. I'll be up for that.
I actually credit the last one, the second. It was called Jurassic Park Lost World, right?
The Lost World colon Jurassic Park.
Yeah, the book was titled the same as well.
Credit that film with a pretty early lesson in how Hollywood works and how sequels can sometimes suck. Because I was very, very excited for that film. And then I went to go see it, and it was maybe the first time I came out of a cinema and went, I know I was supposed to enjoy that, but I just didn't, even though it had all the dinosaurs and stuff in it. And it's a bad film.
With Jurassic Park on, like, kind of saying that, you know, we shouldn't mess with things that we shouldn't really be messing with, you know. I've asked ChatGPT to write our outro for this episode.
Bastard. Don't feed the machine. No.
This is why the Writers Guild of America are striking, Jason.
We've run Netflix shows next.
I'm messing with things... I'm messing with things that we shouldn't be messing with.
Let's have it. So, I get it. Thematically, it works, Jason. I get it. It is. Yes. Get it. Yeah.
It'll probably make a better Jurassic Park sequel. So
it probably would, actually. Yeah.
So it's a one-time. It's a one-time thing. Don't worry, Chris. You know, we'll go back to our normal next time.
I'm just messing with you, Jason.
Oh, no. Anyway, so we greatly appreciate you joining us for this episode. Thank you for listening and being a part of our podcast community. If you enjoy our show, please consider supporting us on Ko-fi. Or coffee, sorry. Your contributions help us continue creating quality content. We would also love to hear your feedback. If you have a moment, please rate and review our podcast on your preferred platform. Your reviews mean the world to us and help others discover our show. Don't forget to join our lively community on our Discord server. There you can engage in discussions, connect with fellow listeners, and stay up to date with the latest happenings. We value your input and look forward to connecting with you.
Kill, 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 kill.
dear. For even more content. Visit our website at thewolfiepod.com. Explore a treasure trove of articles, game reviews, our complete back catalogue of episodes, and much more. It's a hub of entertainment and information that we're excited to share with you. Lastly, if you're listening to us on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel and hit the like button. Your support on our YouTube platform helps us reach a wider audience and grow our community. Thank you again for your support and for being a part of our podcast journey. Chaps, it's time to say goodbye.
I don't know what to say after that. like, goodbye. Goodbye, ChatGPT.
I wasn't expecting something so coherent and sensical.
It's coherent, but it's completely absent any kind of charm or I hate it. It's the most clinical.
It's just like taking the prompt of podcast, please come back, and then filling that. Like,
content, our exciting content hub of entertainment community grow. Press like now. Like, oh, it's horrible.
Yeah. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share.
Yeah. Garbage. Anyway, it's time to say goodbye. So I am Steve, and this is the conclusion of this episode. Goodbye.
Goodness, I can't. Oh, and I'm Richard. I got nothing. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry. I'm Richard. I got nothing. I can't follow what Steve just said. So,
and think about things before you do them, because people like Ian Malcolm will tell you to. Fucking Jesus Christ!
You okay with that? You want to go again or?
My brain is mince, lads. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
You sounded like ChatGPT then.
ChatGPT, yeah.
Have you said goodbye, Chris?
See you later, all. Goodbye.
There you go.
Oh, no.
My name has been Jason, and you've been listening to What's Wrong with Wolfie, a retro podcast to the max. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
need to know. What's wrong with Wolfie? You can hear him barking.